First matter this morning, Don Kincaid versus Erie Insurance Company. Mr. Maestel.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Sean Maestel and Ron Rispo on behalf of Erie Insurance. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I will be sharing my opening time with Marvin Karp from Progressive Insurance as one of the amici, and he will be discussing interpretation of contracts. Ohio's Constitution limits...
Counsel, could you speak into the microphone? We're having a little trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Ohio's Constitution limits common law claims to those matters which are justiciable. This court, for nearly 100 years, has determined that justiciability is determined by whether or not there is an injury in fact, a real dispute, something more than just a mere disagreement between the parties. In this case, Mr. Kincaid and Erie Insurance have absolutely no dispute. There is nothing set forth in the complaint. There is no issues out there which show or entitlement to bring an action in Ohio's Common Pleas Courts.
Counsel, the complaint says that the insured complied in whatever the language is, complied with all the requirements in order to be able to recover the expenses. That's in the complaint. Why isn't that sufficient to create a controversy at the pleading stage?
Well, Your Honor, I believe you're referring to paragraph 33 of his complaint where he states that he's complied with all policy conditions precedent to under the policy. That is a separate – first of all, that's a legal conclusion, first issue. Number two, that's a separate question, whether or not he's met the policy's conditions – which he did not, but whether he met the policy condition is a separate question from standing, which standing involves a legal question of whether or not he actually has an injury in fact, which is justiciable, which can be resolved currently.
But don't we have to go behind the pleadings to determine that? And is this the proper stage to do it?
It is the proper stage to do it because you do not need anything more than the simple question of anywhere in that complaint has Mr. Kincaid set forth that he has an injury or an imminent injury? Has he been harmed as of today, the time he files his complaint, or is it an imminent time in a very near future that he could be harmed but for the intervention of the courts? The simple fact that he says, I've met conditions precedent to the filing of the complaint through the underlying policy, doesn't answer the question of whether or not he's been harmed, whether or not there's any activity, whether there's any acrimony or any real disagreement between Erie and Kincaid, which needs judicial resolvement to answer the question.
So in counsel, you're saying the initial step would have been the presentation of the bill for the reimbursements to be presented pursuant to the contract?
Pursuant to the insurance contract and pursuant to Ohio law as well as all the notable treatises, he had to present to the promisor, Erie, he had to present his claim for expenses or his loss, his claim loss, and that would set forth in motion the process through which Erie would then have a chance to review the materials and determine whether or not those were actual expenses covered by the policy.
Would you address the appellate court's conclusion that because there's no requirement for presentment in the contract, that it wasn't necessary?
Well, it's a basic under Ohio law, under a decision in 1916 by this court in Thomas versus Matthews, this court stated that you have to, the promisee, the person that has the material necessary to determine whether or not a claim can be made, the person with that knowledge has to present it to the other party, the promisor, in order to have a claim under the contract, in order to determine whether or not it's ripe for payment or ripe for a determination or performance by the promisor under the contract.
How would you respond to maybe a statement that because that wasn't reiterated in the contract, that presentment requirement, it's waived?
First of all, it doesn't need to be presented in the contract. There is a notice provision in the contract. This is a supplemental provision of the policy. There's a general notice provision which requires presentment of any loss that you believe is covered by the policy. Secondly, the Ohio's common law requires that in contractual situations, you have to give the promisor the opportunity to perform under the contract before you can file a suit for breach.
Mr. Mestel, then you agree that your client has a duty to pay these charges or pay these damages?
We agreed, as we stated in the answer, that if these are expenses incurred and covered by the policy, Erie would pay them upon presentment of the claim.
Okay. And you maintain, if I understand your answer to Justice O'Connor's question, that there is a notice provision in the policy applicable to these expenses that says you have to be presented notice of them.
There's a general notice provision in the policy that says that any loss must be presented.
All right. Let me ask you a different question. Is there a medical payments policy, medical payments section in this policy?
I believe there is, Your Honor.
Does that have a separate presentment or notice provision contained in that section of the policy?
I don't believe it's contained within that section, Your Honor. But we get to the fact that insurance
so
policy.
So if we analogize from one type of claim or another type of claim, would we be able to say that the same obligation that your client has to pay claims in the medical payments area, for example, requires a presentment, but there's no separate notice of it, and that would same analogy would apply to this payment for these kinds of expenses.
I would agree exactly with what you stated, aside from just not just the policy, but also basic common sense, basic Ohio law, Williston on contracts, Corbin on contracts, the restatement on contracts, all require the presentment. The promisor has nothing to perform for if the presentment has not been made to the promisor. And with regard to the other two claims made, because I'd like to give the rest of my time to Mr. Karp, with regard to bad faith, Ohio law has long been settled that you can't have a bad faith claim until you actually present the claim and it's been rejected. Here, there's acknowledgement. There's never even been a claim made, so therefore there wasn't an opportunity for Erie to reject. And with regard to declaratory judgment, this court in Heasley in 2007 clearly stated that without a imminent harm, a current dilemma, there's no jurisdiction and the courts are closed to that litigant. I would like to give the rest of my time to Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Mr. Mestel.
May it please the court, I'm Marvin Karp. I represent Progressive Insurance, which is one of the amici. As the court is aware, there are several amici in this case, including Progressive, including Nationwide Insurance, including the Ohio Insurance Institute, and the Ohio Association for Civil Trial Attorneys. I'd like to go directly to the question that was addressed raised by Justice O'Connor, which is essentially the point that is made in the plaintiff's brief, which is that, hey, we have a right. I had a right to file suit in this without making any demand at all because the policy itself contained no express provision requiring a presentment of these types of expenses. And since there was no express provision, you cannot imply a provision. Our answer to that is this. We're not dealing here with the situation is if there is no express provision in the policy, that doesn't mean that the contract should be interpreted as intending the exact opposite, meaning that no claim need ever present it. Rather, what we're dealing here is a gap in the contract, a silence. And the law is clear that when you have a silence on a point in a contract, the courts and the parties should infer by a good faith interpretation to fill that particular gap. And we have cited in our briefs, both briefs filed by Progressive, our principal brief and the reply brief, a recent case of the Sixth Circuit 2 years ago, Savedorf against Access Group, Inc., which is 524 F3rd, 754 at 763, where the court applying Ohio law stated quite clearly that if the contract is silent, as opposed to being ambiguous with respect to a particular matter, the parties to the contract are required to use good faith to fill the gap of a silent contract. There's not a rewriting of the policy. It's not giving a liberal interpretation to a clear and unambiguous language. It's a gap. And the way it is to be filled is by a good faith interpretation.
Well, whether it's good faith or not, isn't the issue here whether or not they're standing to present such a claim?
I couldn't hear your question, Justice O'Donnell. I'm sorry.
Regardless of the good faith, isn't the issue here whether or not there is standing to present this claim?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You agree entirely with what Mr. Metzl said. Indeed, you know, the time and the resources of our courts are precious resources of our society. And this court should not allow a lawsuit to be filed by somebody who really doesn't have a dispute.
Well, the strongest argument we're going to hear, I think, is I have a legitimate claim. I just didn't tell them about it. I've presented it, and I'm entitled to payment pursuant to the terms of the contract. And why isn't that a reasonable position that might give standing?
We don't think so because of the fact is that you have to have a dispute. Let's assume that this particular motorist, there was a collision, and you have damage to your car. Do you simply sit silent and don't tell the insurance company, but go into court and file a lawsuit against the insurance company, your insurance company, for failing to pay your collision damage? You don't have standing. There is no dispute. If you had presented it, we'd be over. The court should not be tolerating that type of litigation.
Mr. Karp, isn't this actually an issue about pleading and about whether a generalized statement, the plaintiff has fully complied with the conditions precedent to getting satisfied, isn't that adequate? Certainly, certain kinds of claims, such as fraud, require particularized pleading. But generally, that's not the case. Isn't the generalized statement here adequate for pleading purposes?
We do not think so, Mr. Chief Justice. In our situation, we're dealing with a motion for judgment on the pleadings, in which the court should take into account the answer, not only the complaint itself. The answer affirmatively alleges that there was no claim presented here. It alleges that the practice of the company has been to pay claims when they are presented. And therefore, more than this open, broad conclusion, a conclusionary statement should suffice, particularly where the plaintiff says there is no requirement, and therefore there is no condition precedent. And therefore, the allegation we've complied with condition precedent doesn't cover this situation since there was no condition.
Wouldn't this best be dealt with through motion for summary judgment, where the company could affirmatively establish the fact of whether or not there had been presentment and whether there were damages to be considered?
I suppose one way of doing it would be that way. The problem is we've got a class action situation here in which the court may say, let's go and have all this class action discovery before we get to this type of issues on the merits of the case.
And I'm glad you mentioned it. Isn't that what this litigation is all about?
Precisely. And that's our concern in this situation is what happens if the court affirms this? Are the insurance companies to be hit every couple of years with the same class action? All of these claims that people have supposedly gone out and incurred postage stamp expenses and parking fees to go to depositions. Every couple of years, you hit them with another class action, and the insurance industry is caught in this situation. What is the insurance companies to do faced with this type of dilemma?
Well, they'll quickly change their policies, won't they? That's what they do every time they get hit with something they
It's
don't
not
like.
That easy, Mr. Justice. It's the situation to change a policy is kind of like turning a battleship around. These are standard forms, as the court is well aware.
You're saying every 2 years, I realize in the interim of 2, 4, 6 years.
Right.
But they can change the policy year two tops.
The policy is a standard policy, which virtually all the companies utilize.
So they all have to have a prayer meeting before they
That is right, and they have to be reasoned. Right now, there's only one court in the whole country that has ever held that in this particular situation, you can go ahead and sue without presentment. That court in the whole country is the 8th District Court of Appeals, which is not enough to turn the battleship, so to speak.
That's a pretty important court, though, don't you think, Mr. Karp? That's a pretty important court.
It's a wonderful court, Your Honor. Wonderful court. And I've lived for it for 52 years, and I have highly respect for it. Mr. Chief Justice, I think I'm encroaching on the time and rebuttal time. If I've got another minute, or I do not.
If you're finished with what you have to present, there's no questions.
No, my point is that what we do is we urge the court to hold that anyone who has a claim of such a nature has an obligation to present the claim. And that the court should hold that someone who comes in and files suit without ever having presented a claim, made a demand for payment, has no standing as a matter of law to pursue that particular claim. I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Karp. Mr. Flowers?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. Flowers, I'll bet you think that 8th District is a pretty good court, don't you?
I enjoy my time up at the 8th District. And just while we're on that point, I'd like to point out that the 8th District is far from the only court that has accepted our positions in this regard. In the Kavoris decision, Judge Donald Nugent, who's also a respected jurist in Cleveland and a former 8th District member, concluded he agreed with us in one of these cases that there's nothing in these policies that prohibits the insureds from bringing suit immediately to collect their benefits. And we also had a decision out of the Southern District
Counsel,
of Florida.
Counsel, what's the sense of doing that?
Of seeking the benefits this way?
Yeah. Why not just give a bill to the insurance company and say, listen, I spent $3 for postage, and I've got a parking fee for $10, and, you know, blah, 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 and have them pay it. What's your end game here?
Well, the end game here is getting the benefits not just for Mr. Kincaid, but for all the insureds. Everybody who's entitled to it.
So why don't they all put their bills into Erie Insurance and Westfield and everybody that has this provision? Let's just get them paid directly and cut out the middleman, which is you.
My guess is, you know, and we're straying far from the pleadings here, but my guess is that it's because they just don't know. They don't appreciate that these benefits are there for them.
So you want the court to read the contract for them and solve their problem because they don't know? Why don't you, as an attorney, tell them? Instead of coming to court and spending our time to collect postage and parking for something that hasn't even been submitted as a bill.
I had a feeling that answer is going to open up a can of worms. It's very clear to me. These people are entitled to money because the policy promises it. And it may not be much, but it's in there. They have a clause in their policy that says you are entitled to this compensation. That's their promise to their insureds. They have to live up to that. So this idea that we're somehow being unfair by asking them to abide by their policies and pay these people what they're owed.
That's not the allegation that you're being unfair by asking them to pay. What I heard and what I've read is that give us the bill and we will abide by the contract. But we're not mind readers. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what your postage and parking and ancillary costs have been. Let us know and we give us a chance to review, and we will either accept or reject. If they reject, then you may have a role here. But until that's done, what kind of advice is an attorney such as yourself giving to these people? Don't present a bill. Let's wait. We'll take them to court.
I'm afraid the court is taking their arguments, their representations at face value. They do know. They know these people are entitled to compensation. They know these people have incurred expenses. They've asked them to.
Well, let me get you to a legal issue, Mr. Flowers.
Okay.
Do you agree this is a matter of standing?
Standing has been raised, and it's something we have to satisfy.
Do you agree that that is the issue?
Yes.
The claim would be there's no justiciable controversy because no expense advancement has been denied.
Correct.
So there's nothing at issue between the parties, and therefore you just can't come in without having the prerequisite of having made a claim that was rejected.
Well, and that's
so that leads to the issue as to whether you have standing to present the claim in the first place.
Correct. And that is an overly strict view of standing. They don't have a case that actually says that in order to have standing, you must have presentment and rejectment.
Well, if you don't think it's a standing issue, what issue legally do you think we're confronted with?
Well, I think it's a standing issue. They have raised standing. And,
oh, you agree it's standing.
Right. I don't agree with their interpretation of the case law.
Right. Okay. What is your interpretation of it?
I read their case law, and I agree with every word of it. I mean, you have to have standing. And the long-accepted definition of standing is having a real, justiciable stake in the controversy.
Well, if no one has denied any claim, there's nothing at issue between the parties, so there isn't any standing.
Right, and that's just it. This idea of the denial, that's not part of standing. Standing is just, if you win, will you benefit? And that's absolutely the case here.
Well, how could a carrier absolve itself from or exonerate itself from any liability in connection with a claim presented by one of your clients, for example, if it didn't know that your client was employed or how many hours your client had taken off work or what that rate of pay was or what the parking charges were if they took the bus? I mean, they can't just be mind readers about these things.
Well, and that's what I was trying to...
Isn't it just common sense that the claimant would say, these are my expenses. I think you owe me X number of dollars. You have to pay that to me.
It's common sense for a sophisticated individual who understands that they need to do this. And I think what we're losing track of here is this is not a situation where they're allowed to sit back and say, bring it to us, let us know. There's no obligation on us. Ohio insurance law doesn't work that way.
Well, how about in the medical payment section? I asked the other side about the fact that we have a policy that says we will reimburse your medical expenses in the case up to $1,000.
Right.
Maybe policy owners don't read that and know that, but when they retain counsel, generally the lawyer will say, collect all the medical bills and give them to me. I will submit them for collection. So why wouldn't the same obtain if there's no notice provision for medical payments? Why wouldn't that obtain to these kinds of reimbursement?
Well, counsel was incorrect, first of all, in his response. They have a clause in their policy that's called suits against us. And it was the focus of their motion for judgment on the pleadings originally. And it says you have to submit notice to them and give them 30 days to reject on a medical payments claim and on comprehensive collision claim. All right, so in that medical payment situation, they do have the right to present men and an opportunity to deny. That clause is very specific that it's limited to medical payments and comprehensive and collision. It does not apply to a liability coverage claim as we have here.
That's the Erie policy.
Correct, the Erie policy.
Okay. All right.
And that is the key because they have specifically put that requirement in there for those types of coverage. They have not for this type of coverage. The additional payments benefits we're seeking is under the liability section. They expressly excluded it. And the courts just are not in the business of rewriting policies, putting language back in that should have been included to kind of save the day, regardless of the implications.
So let me get this straight. You say that for medical or for other damages, they have to present and give the insurance company 30 days to reject after reviewing the documentation. In this case, for postage and parking, the insurance company has to go to the policyholder and say, listen, there's a clause in your contract that I'd like to remind you of, and that says that we'll pay up to $100 in lost wages, and we'll also pay, you know, these other incidentals. Do you have any incidentals? Is that what you're saying is their obligation?
Yes.
Where is that spelled out? Where's the case law that supports that affirmative duty on the insurance company to do with just that?
It's in a regulation in the from the Department of Insurance. It's Ohio Advised Administrative Code, section sign 3901-1-54E. You don't need the section sign. It was dictating there. But under that section, and it reads, an insurer shall fully disclose to first-party claimants all pertinent benefits, coverages, or other provisions of an insurance contract under which claim is presented.
So you don't think that disclosure is met by giving the customer a copy of the insurance policy where everything is spelled out in black and white in English? That's not apprising the... You want them to have to go a step further?
Yes. If that's the rule, that all you have to do is give them the policy, then this provision becomes superfluous. The regulation has no effect whatsoever because everybody gets a policy. They can always say, aha, we satisfied the Department of Insurance demand that we specifically advise them because we gave them their policy. This goes beyond that. It clearly directs that once you have this claim, that is the liability claim that was presented here, we presented a proof of loss, once you've done that, then the insurer has an obligation to advise you of all the benefits available. Medical coverage would be one.
But, Mr. Flowers, that regulation doesn't say orally advised, does it?
It does not. Shall fully disclose to first-party
claimant. Fully disclose. So a full disclosure can be done, as Justice O'Connor suggests, in writing.
Correct.
Where parties are told, this is your contract, read it, look at it, here are your rights, here are your obligations. And you're saying that this regulation goes beyond and requires oral discussion? Is that what you're saying?
No, I never said oral discussion. I never used those words.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that they have to fully disclose once the claim is made and accepted. So once you have somebody who's approved for coverage here, provided with a defense attorney, provided with indemnity for an accident, the insurance company has to tell them everything that's available to them, and that would include these additional benefits. And insurance companies do that. State Farm sends letters out to people who have been approved for liability coverage saying, and remember, your expenses can be reimbursed at the end of the case, and it's in a letter that they send out. If we accept that all you have to do is give them the policy, then this regulation has no meaning whatsoever. It becomes just a nullity. And I don't believe the Department of Insurance adopted this just to have some superfluous regulation on the books that no one really has to follow.
Was Mr. Kincaid represented by counsel in his lawsuit?
Yes. Erie provided him with
the attorney. Doesn't the counsel have some obligation to advise his clients of all his rights and benefits?
Yes.
Have you sued his counsel?
No. It's an issue that's been kicked around because it's very dicey. The attorney was provided by Erie to Mr. Kincaid.
Okay.
Being paid by Erie.
And when you represent Mr. Kincaid now, and you read the policy, did you advise him, why don't you send your bills in and get them paid?
We advised him and talked to him about a situation, which I can't go into. The decision was made to proceed with a class action.
So you said you apparently didn't tell him you can submit your claim, and if it's valid, it'll get paid. Instead, hire me, and I'll pay me a third, and I'll file a class action? Is that what you said?
Well, I can't go into what I said, but I can assure you that I met all of my ethical responsibilities by fully advising him of all his rights, and he made his decision.
Counsel, let me ask you, what is Mr. Kincaid's claim in this case? What is he asking for?
Mr. Kincaid has alleged in the complaint lost time from work, and we're not talking about just postage here. These people do get up to $100 a day for mm-hmm. lost time from work. To attend a deposition, he had travel expenses there. And just to get back to the Kincaid.
What is the total of his expenses?
That I don't know offhand.
Are they detailed in the complaint?
No.
So the insurance company still doesn't know what he's asking for, is that right?
No, the insurance company could have done discovery, but we went off on this motion practice.
Okay, so he didn't file a request for payment, file a complaint, and you still don't even have it in the complaint, which in this case would be the first notice that they got, and you're going to wait till discovery before you're going to tell him what it is he incurred or thinks he's entitled to.
Well, you know.
How does this make any sense? I go back to one of the first questions. How does this make any sense?
It makes sense.
I mean, even now the insurance company can't write him a check because he won't tell him what he's owed.
Right now the insurance company could write him a check. You're right. They would have to know how much he is owed. We didn't get into that just because this motion for judgment of the pleadings was filed before there's any discovery. All right, so we went down that road rather than the usual road of discovery. And he is seeking his benefits, which a lot of people are entitled to, not just him. And this is not something we concocted. It's a promise made in these policies. And we've got this kind of don't ask, don't tell practice going on here where, despite the regulation, they're not going to tell anybody about it until they're approached.
You're asking for damages in addition to what he actually incurred as part of this class action?
Oh, no. He's just seeking the benefits that he's entitled to.
Mr. Flowers, I think what we're all struggling with is, in many respects, your argument is compelling, and you may have the superior legal position in this case. And one would not, by ruling against you, want to foreclose cases in which, although it's ordinarily not the practice that you go to court before you tell the defendant the nature of your claim. But there certainly could be circumstances in which, for a variety of reasons, that's what a lawyer might want to do. But it's this class action for de minimis claims. And the I think intuitively we know the end result of this is if this goes forward and is successful, the lawyers will be well compensated, and most of the people that have claims won't ever collect a nickel because they won't fill out the forms that are required when that notice comes in the mail.
Well,
I mean, that's always the problem with class actions, but right. I think this case has the potential for giving class actions a really bad name. They don't enjoy a great reputation already, but
Well, let me say this. One of the cases they've cited is Lichen versus Lumbermans, which we settled last year. Actually, we settled it before they cited it. And that's a case where, yes, it was de minimis. People got a set amount of money. But I'm quite sure the 800 or so of them who got it were pleased to get it. And, yes, they had to fill out forms and so forth, and a lot of them did. And those who didn't at that point, you know, they'd had their notice. They'd been advised. They fully appreciated their
rights.
Do you
follow up with those clients and hold their hands and fill out the forms for them and put the postage on it and send it back?
No, we didn't have to do any of that.
Oh, okay.
But the people, once they understood their rights, as the regulation and the fiduciary responsibilities required, at that point they did get their money that they were entitled to under the policies. So well, that,
you know, that, I want to follow up. I'm just troubled. You know, it seems like there's a tipping point here. There is also an important function for class actions where there are manufacturers and others just doing purely evil things, but the harm is slight to each individual, and but for a class action, they're going to go right on doing that. This doesn't seem to be in that genre.
Well, I would put it, and I'll just finish up with this, I would put it right in the genre with cases like Cope versus Metropolitan Insurance Company, which this case court decided in 1998. And that's another case that was based upon a violation of an insurance regulation, and the amounts involved were small. But that's what happens. We have this tendency on the part of several insurers and other businesses to break the law when the harm is mild, because people can't sue individually to get their money back. They can't do it on a one-by-one basis. And so, yes, the amounts are small, but that's why we have a class action, because it's the only way to
They could solve this problem, I think, to your satisfaction, if – when they notify the Mr. Kincaids of the world that we're going to provide you a lawyer to defend this suit, but it's going to and you're required under the policy to cooperate, and that may take some time on your part, and you're entitled to certain compensation for that time off work and that kind of thing. If that expressly laid out in a letter at the start, you would be satisfied, right?
Yeah. You know, in this whole case, really, all this boils down to why don't we just tell these people that they have these benefits in their policies? Telling them to just read their policies isn't enough. Why don't we just set it out to them and let them make their claims? And really, in a class action, that's all that may happen, is that they'll get their notices and it'll go out, and then the law has been fully fulfilled at that point. That's all that's really being asked for here. And the Lichen settlement wasn't huge. No lawyers got rich over it. But at the same time, people who were deserving of policy benefits got those policy benefits. So with that, we'd ask you to affirm the 8th District. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. Mr. Mitchell, you may have 2 minutes. Or is it Mr. Crispo?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to go to the last point first, if I may. An insurance policy contains 7 or 8 different coverages, and under those different coverages, there are subparts, as many as 3 or 4 subparts. That's 32, at a minimum, types of coverages which might be available in a given fact or circumstance. If it were necessary for an insurer to supply additional written notices to the insured for every individual coverage, that could be as many as 30 to 40 additional written notices.
Oh, and so the insured should just have the tough luck of having to figure out all 32 of these when your company is furnishing the lawyer, and not just furnishing, tell them this is the lawyer you have to have in this case. How much difficult when you tell them this is the lawyer you have to have, you certainly tell them you have a duty to cooperate with that lawyer. You even tell them how they may have to plead on a criminal charge to plead no contest instead of admitting guilt. So why can't you tell them at that time, well, we expect you to cooperate with the lawyer? It may take some of your time, and your policy provides that you can get up to $100 a day for the time that we require of you to help us defend.
With all due respect, Your Honor, that's only one of maybe 30 or 40 different types of issues that could arise under a policy. In fact, the insurer has provided the insured with a copy of the policy.
Oh, great.
If he were to provide additional notices for every conceivable fact situation, and when would they be provided? At the beginning of the suit, in the middle of the suit, at the end of the suit? And if the notice didn't anticipate every conceivable fact situation, then it would be claimed that the insurer had created reliance, soothing advertisings, and it would become the basis for another class action. That's not what we're about here. We're about common sense. The policy says if the expense is incurred, if there is an actual loss of earnings, we will pay. Now, if the insured is the average person who has ever submitted a receipt for petty cash payments, he knows that when he has incurred an expense, he has to submit the amount and documentation of the amount before he's paid. This coverage is supplemental. It is supplemental to the liability coverage. It is supplemental to the liability coverage, which in turn has a notice requirement. The notice requirement is under paragraph 11C3, which provides that a proof of loss may be submitted. A liability endorsement notice applies to all coverages under liability coverage, including the supplemental payments. Anybody who reads the policy would know that if they exercise common sense. Now, you might say, should they not have submitted another copy of the insurance policy to the insured so it would incorporate and it would anticipate every possible fact scenario that might arise during the adjustment of the claim? Yes, it would be possible, but if we submitted another copy of the policy to the insured, what assurance do we have that the insured would read it if he hasn't read the policy the first time around?
Are you shocked to learn that most people don't read their policies?
I am not shocked that they don't read them when they first arrive in their mail, but I am shocked that they would not read it once a suit or a claim arises. If I had water in my basement, I assure you I'd be reading my policy very carefully to see whether I have sewer backup coverage.
Presumably when the insurance company notifies them that Ron Rispo will be representing you in this matter, that the insured sits back and figures Ron Rispo is going to take care of my interests.
Insofar as any claim that's brought against me by the adverse party, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Rispo.
Thank you, Your Honor.